welcome to the Gravel Junction podcast, your meeting place for all things bikes, adventures, and the stories that follow. I'm your host, Shaul Detmer. Hello, everyone. Welcome back to the Gravel Junction podcast, episode 4 today. Bit of a different layout today in that it's just me, myself, and I on the show. A number of reasons for that, which I'll get to in a moment. But I thought, you know, despite not being able to bring you the guest that I was hoping to bring today due to some work commitments, I thought, well, there's still a bunch of things I wanted to talk about and we could put a good show out. As you would have seen in the show notes, I'm going to have a bit of a chin wag today to myself and you, the lovely listeners, about gravel in the world of the World Tour and the Pro Peloton. I myself am a massive fan of road cycling and road racing and have been since I was the age of, seven, sitting there in my school holidays watching the entire Tour de France to my grandmother's dismay. So a lot of that's, okay, no secret, gravel's a bit of a thing, we know that, and it has been in professional racing for some time. Some would argue the Tour de France, originally 100 years ago, was a gravel race. I get that. But going to unpack a few things with regards to in the perspective of current races and how they fit in and different opinions of gravel in today's racing world. A popular race, one that we know so much of, is the Strada Bianchi, one of my personal favorites, and I think a personal favorite of many cycling fans. Only about 15 years old, I think 2007 was the first event. For those of you who don't or aren't familiar with the Strada Bianchi, it's the beautiful race on the white roads of Tuscany, starting and finishing in Siena. Just a stunning race visually. When you have the Gruber photography team, everybody waits eagerly to see what masterpieces they create in those white dusty clouds. It really is a wonderful watch. You know, a wonderful race to watch. And in this year, something I kind of missed initially, and then luckily I managed to see it in time before watching it, was the Clásica Jaén Paraíso Interior, or as some are calling it, the Spanish Strada Bianchi, held in the province of Jaén in Andalusia, Spain. Won this year, first event, by Alexey Lutsenko. What a stunning race. I don't know if any of you managed to catch the race. It was only the last 47 kilometers were televised, something that I think will change next year because it was beautiful. The scenery, you know, the olive grove lined gravel climbs, steep climbs, cobble climbs. The steep cobbled climb into the Finnish Old Town was brutal to say the least, but enthralling TV viewing. And I think that's the key to a lot of what we're going to talk about today, is how this sort of riding or this sort of racing, including it, how it draws the numbers. And I don't have to tell a lot of you out there, at the moment the cycling sponsorship model is somewhat, well, let's just say maybe needs some work. Many people much smarter than me have attempted that and not seem to have got anywhere, but hopefully we can find solutions. Maybe it's, you know, how do you eat an elephant? One step at a time. And one of those steps could be, not that I condone eating elephants, I should say that. It's a metaphor. One of those steps could be the inclusion of gravel racing or gravel sectors, gravel stages. And this is where the sort of contention seems to lie. I should also say, no women's event this year for the Clásica Jaén. Think that'll be different next year after seeing the popularity of this event. Anyway, back to my previous thought. The likes of Chris Froome, Remco Evenepoel, making comments, not necessarily saying no gravel in racing, but it's something that needs to be considered, especially perhaps in Grand Tour events such as the Tour, the Vuelta, Giro d'Italia, where a stray stone in the gravel stage cost GC his race. Now, I know many of you would be clambering now, hitting wooden spoons and pots, shouting at me, going, well, if you're going to win a Grand Tour, you have to be able to ride everything. Time trial, climb, sprint, and now gravel. I get that, and I'm actually very much in that camp. That being said, as a host of the show, I need to do my utmost to maintain my partiality. We'll go with that. Impartiality probably is better. However, if I put myself, so I'm a bit of a Roglic fan, big Roglic fan. If I was watching the race and a gravel stage, final few days of the tour, happened to cost that unlucky fellow his chance at the yellow jersey on the Champs-Élysées, I would not, they would sting a bit. They would definitely sting a bit. So when I look at it from that perspective, I'm like, yeah, okay, I can understand that. And while watching the Classic Ajayen the other day, my favorite, Brian Smithy-Smith, was commentating, and he made a very valid point, which I thought, he goes, gravel racing, amazing, here to stay. He also sees both sides of the story. Perhaps the first step in allaying people's fears is to just have gravel-specific events like Classic Ajayen, like Strada Bianchi, those sort of days where the racers know what they're getting into. And I can appreciate that. It's like Paris-Roubaix. From a technical point of view, teams can prepare accordingly. Not to say they can't do that in a stage race. I hear that. But just like in Paris-Roubaix, where the likes of tubeless tires, etc., that technology is becoming more and more popular in the pro peloton. And I think as this technology improves, especially in road cycling, perhaps we'll get to the point where there's enough trust and reliability in equipment to put these sort of stages in the big grand tours that it's not as much of an issue. I'm not sure if we're particularly there yet. Me, personally, I am very much team no tube inside. Sorry to Kaylee Fritz and the others over at our competitor, their cycling tips, who are massively team tube inside. I ride tubeless both gravel and road, and yes, I've had one episode on the road bike where it went spectacularly wrong, and that was purely my own fault. I rode a tire that 2 weeks prior I'd had a big crash, and then I tried to ride it again, mainly due to the fact that there were no tires in stock, and lo and behold, on a bit of a long ride, that blew up in my face. It was fine, put a tube in, got home. That is the only time. And when riding what we call the Cape Town World Cup circuit, that beautiful Cape Town Nürtuk route, as many of you listeners will know, it can be pretty glassy on those roads. No issues. Touching a lot of wood as I say that. Touching wood, because now I'm sure the next time I get on the bike, that'll be an issue. But yes, so technology, I think, is also a factor. And hopefully that will improve, because going back to my previous comment about sponsorship and that particular model, we need people to watch our sport. And lots of people tune in to watch the likes of Strada Bianchi, and I think a lot of people next year will tune in to watch Classico Jaén. And you have a gravel stage in the Tour de France, every cycling media publication, podcast, news show, when they do their preview of the 5 stages to watch in this year's tour, guaranteed the gravel stage is in there. That's more publicity. That's good for cycling. That's good for the brand, for the sport. And that can't be ignored. We have to embrace those sort of things. I think another point with that, though, on a bit of a tangent, as they include gravel, I do think it's important that we, personally, I'd like to see that the lines between the different disciplines are kept relatively clear. With the gravel, UCI no doubt getting into the gravel racing and the gravel World Cup, World Championships, it's going to be a thing. Some people are very upset by it. Personally, I think it's fine. Like, let there be a clear-cut team event, world champs. You know, you're going for that jersey, elite. And that way, your mass participation events, your Unbound Gravel, your Granduro, all those sort of things, maintain their original, you know, their authenticity of just pitch up, ride your bike, test yourself, have a great time. If you want to go there for your KOM and, you know, go for the podium, that's great. But we are seeing that a little bit, and we discussed this last week with Raphael from Orbit 360. you know, some of these unsupported bikepacking events, which in the spirit of the race, clues in the name, unsupported, you're seeing these athletes come in and seem rather supported in their attempts to win the race. I'm not judging that. I get it. Perhaps the platform isn't there yet to separate them, and that's why perhaps the likes of a UCI-sanctioned world championship event will allow that to keep those separate. That's great. I mean, can you imagine Matthew van der Poel, Van Aert blasting down, going for the gravel world champs? What, do you have team cars? Are they tech support? Do they have to fix their own punctures? Like, those are all things I can't wait to see. But let's keep that over there. And over here, yeah, a little a light sprinkle, a little bit of spice as far as throwing in these gravel sectors into races. Poh, bring it on. All for that. Times like this, I wish this was a radio call-in show. For all you masses of people out there listening, could call in and give me your heated, your hot takes, as they like to say, on this particular subject. Maybe through the Gravel Junction podcast, or sorry, the Gravel Junction Instagram page, get a bit of a conversation going and see what people's thoughts are on this, because yeah, I tend to think that most people will be on the gravel side of things. And that's coming from someone as a bit of a purist as far as the road racing goes. I love, you know, the romance of the of cycling and its history. But just like the Tour de France 100 years ago was basically a gravel race, we need to adapt and bring more people on bikes as well. You know, gravel, as we've said many times on this show, gravel is the key, I think, to doing that. So yeah, that's kind of my thoughts on that. For those of you wondering why it's just me on the show today, going back to my comments at the start of the show, so like I said, Gravel Junction, it's kind of my new baby. I'm thoroughly enjoying the whole podcasting process, the interviews, the technical side, and realizing the amount of hours that goes into making one of these episodes. It's a little bit crazy. It is certainly not earning me any money at this point, and that's not the reason I'm doing it. But that being said, day jobs are a thing. That's the thing probably for many podcast hosts out there and podcast shows. So my particular day job, something I've been doing for a long time, I'm a seafarer. I work at sea. So as I speak to you right now, I've just sailed past the southern tip of Sri Lanka, taking a vessel from East Asia, Southeast Asia, all the way to Northern Europe. That's right, a somewhat 8,000-odd nautical mile odyssey through some interesting bodies of water, especially this time of the year. The Mediterranean and the North Atlantic in late winter can be cute, would be a word, with massive sarcasm. Yeah, get a bit bumpy, but that's what I do, and that's where the wonders of technology are, sitting here with my little podcast kit in my cabin, in between bridge watches, that's what, literally, as the name says, up on the bridge for 8 hours a day and making sure to navigate the vessel safely on its way. But in between that, eating, bit of exercise, bit of rest, and recording a podcast, putting it out to the people who want to hear it. So that's also great. You know, that's something to be able to do. And that's another reason I wanted to do the show. I was like, oh, well, this couple of weeks, how am I going to do this? One of the benefits of this particular trip is I am ending up in Europe, and I already have a number of great guests lined up that now, instead of doing it remotely, I'm hopefully going to be stopping in a number of European cities and recording face-to-face, with the final destination being my kind of home away from home, Girona in Spain. Going to see some good friends over there, do some riding, and catch up with a couple folks and hopefully bring you some good interviews. So yeah, bit of a shorter show today, as I said. I think there's probably only so much of this face for radio that you wonderful listeners can take. But to finish off the show, I thought I would do a little bit of something inspired by, yeah, Ruleur magazine, their podcast. I love their long conversations when they read articles from the magazines. Not for everyone, I understand, especially in today's now generation, where I've realized you're lucky if someone reads the first 5 lines of your Instagram post or any post. But there are still those out there who love a good story and a good read. So writing is something that I like to dabble in. And so I thought I'd finish off the show with reading an article I recently wrote for a slack pack or a little short bike packing trip I did 3 days with my friend Nick down in the Overberg region of the Western Cape, South Africa. Nothing spectacular, stayed at some Airbnbs, but it was just a really, really great little trip, a little mini staycay. Seeing all that is wonderful about putting some bags on your bicycle and hitting the gravel roads, less traffic, good company, testing yourself physically. Yeah, it was a great trip, and I thought I'd put it down in words to go along with some of the photos. So thank you again. I'll probably see you on the other side of my little reading here, but I'll leave you with my article, Far Not Far, by me. See you on the other side. It is fair to say recent experience with the pandemic has in many cases forced us to review how we look at things, including travel. For obvious reasons, many of us have had to keep it local and make the best of the nearby surroundings. The amount of times I've pulled out my Slingsby maps, other maps are of course available, of places situated in the extremities of our vast country, feeling that in order to experience true adventure and escape, I'm required to first drive to faraway places along roads that can only be described as car killers. Corrugated gravel roads with wire fences and a spattering of lopsided windmills in the distance. The Tankwa, the Cedarburg. You get the picture. Now, of course, heading to these well-known and remote destinations will almost certainly pass the adventure litmus test, providing excitement, isolation, and anxiety all smooshed together like a hastily made roadside salt and vinegar chip roll. Should time and equipment allow you to venture out this far, then power to you. But what if it can't? What if you are able to only steal away last minute on a Friday with the strict requirement to be back home to help with the kids by the time the Carte Blanche intro starts to play? What then? Well, this is where the concept of far not far comes to the fore. By thinking a little out the box to allow yourself to still enjoy the experience of a remote adventure, feeling like you might be at least 4 hours from civilization when in fact there is an engine one stop about 3 kilometers to your right. This is a theory I recently put to the test. The idea initially popped up due to a crash I'd had a couple weeks prior after losing a game of chicken at 40 kilometers an hour with a grapefruit-sized rock. So there I was, sitting there, laying there, in my apartment, sans pants to allow the skin on my rear end the best chance of healing, watching my already laughable fitness slip away as quickly as the hummus and crackers I was consuming. From this, there grew an urge to get away. Adventure was calling. I had to answer this call. Being a last-minute idea, I was unsure who would be able to join me, so I went with the build-it-and-they-will-come approach, starting with distance, in this case 350 kilometers to be ridden over 3 days. We were after a short whiff of adventure before being back in time to catch the first calming tones of Mr. Derek Watts. For our international listeners, it should be noted that Carte Blanche with presenter Derek Watts is a well-known local Sunday evening investigative news show that has seemingly been around forever, and for many of us, hearing that intro jingle at 7 p.m. sends shivers down the spine. The weekend is officially over. Now, deciding on a format for the trip, the conclusion was reached that riding to our base camp instead of driving would up the authenticity factor, and so a slack packing trip was deemed the way forward. Basically, throw some bags on the bike with food, tools and off-bike clothes, but stay in accommodation instead of camping. This helps in a number of ways. Firstly, there is the hot shower and the running water after a long hard day on the bike, as well as negating the need to carry large amounts of food as you can buy from the local shops at your destination. Only one set of cycling gear is needed too. By throwing in a little Ziploc bag of washing powder, you can wash everything in the sink and it'll be dry-ish by morning. This also leaves space for a rain jacket, as you never know how the weather turns out. Lastly, the lack of tents or sleeping bag is a big help with keeping the weight down. Next came our starting point, something within 2 hours drive from Cape Town Centre. Nowadays, we are fortunate to have at our disposal a plethora of fantastic apps and programs to assist with route planning. After some time playing with different routes, a short transfer by car to the beautiful town of Franschhoek showed itself as a good starting point. A quick WhatsApp to a friend with safe parking in the area, and our start-finish point was confirmed. For this particular trip, it was decided to use the quaint little town of Greyton as our base for the few days, which also meant that for the second day we could ride without all our bags weighing us down. In the meantime, only one of my riding buddies was available for all 3 days, so instead of a group, we were now a far not far duo. So we were all set, parking secured, route dialed in, accommodation booked, way too much food packed, and bikes ready to roll. The first leg would take us over Franschhoek Pass, across the Tiervaterskloof Dam and along winding gravel roads, including a wonderful stretch along the railway line before a tough few rolling climbs into Greyton. Although a seemingly tame distance of 100 kilometers with 1,400 meters of climbing, the additional 10 kilograms of weight and 37 degree temperature certainly added to the difficulty level. You know the feeling. Every so often looking down to see if your back wheel is flat, only to realize that, no, it's not flat, I just have no power. One of the challenges of this particular route was the lack of towns or shops along the way, and so water soon became a bit of an issue in the high temperatures. Luckily, a friendly farmer allowed us to top up our bottles from his overflowing rain catchment tank, a rarity in these parts. Anyway, we were back on our way. Arriving in Greyton in the early afternoon, we rolled down the main street feeling as we had just conquered the Munger. Any moment, excited onlookers would make themselves known, throwing admiration and oohs and ahs in our direction. Our salt-encrusted lycra was a clear sign that we were legitimate adventurers. Reality soon set in. It was midday on a Sunday in Greyton, and the members of ASRA, the Atlantic Seaboard Range Rover Association, had all returned to their homes in time for the sunset, and of course, Mr. Watts. This left us having to congratulate ourselves, which we duly did with a plate of carbs and beer. Then off we went to chase that hot shower and wash some lycra in a sink. At this stage, the purists might say that it is not bikepacking unless you sleep rough in a tent, and to a point I agree. However, remember that this is not what we were after here. All that really counted was being out on our bikes with friends, knocking back the kilometers, clearing the mind, and reliving the day later that evening over a beer while adding significant gradient to the biggest climb of the day story. This was about experience, about leaving our comfort zone, no matter how near or far. Feeling the heat from the day's excursions, we finished off the necessary chores, including replenishing food supplies and washing bikes, and called it a day. Sleep came easily. Day two was penciled in as the Queen stage, a 150-kilometer gravel monster from Greyton around and down to Napier and back, the route creating a Strava art-worthy map of the African continent. However, feeling the effects of the previous day's ride and facing another 38-plus degree day with limited water stops, we decided to shorten the ride to a more manageable distance of 100 kilometers and about 1,300 meters of climbing. This was another big lesson for us. Sometimes you just need to check the ego and go with what feels right. Now, I'm pretty sure that my riding partner and I were more than capable enough to churn our way through the original route, most likely arriving back home with heatstroke and a signed friendship divorce. But that was not what we were looking for. We were more about the enjoyment of it all. Rather shorten things, have a few more stops, take a few more photos, and really let it all set in. As it was, the strong wind, well known in these parts, reared its head in the last few kilometers to quickly remind us how much of a slog that extra 50 kilometers would have been. A dip in the cool waters of the Rafiasona End River was the prize awaiting us after those brutal and bumpy final few kilometers. Sufficiently cooled from our little swim, we once again rolled into Greyton with high expectations of some sort of welcome or recognition of our day's grueling battle. We saw a dog. Oh well, shower time. Sitting in a local restaurant for lunch, legs aching, bodies tired, we both acknowledged the slightly daunting idea that we still had to ride home the next day. Seemingly obvious, but an altogether different experience from the usual drive there, ride the day, drive home scenario. With 200 kilometers already in the legs, a 100 kilometer final day with fully loaded bikes would certainly leave us feeling like we had worked for it. With that in mind, any potential weight-saving measures that could be taken were immediately put into practice. Half a bag of pretzels, ate it all, got stomach cramps. Half a tube of travel-sized toothpaste, used it all, looked like I had rabies. But the pièce de résistance, without doubt, would be the large tub of chamois cream with at least 3 rides worth of cream left. This was not enough to warrant taking the tub back with me, nor could I just throw it away. No, no. Instead, I proceeded to lather the chamois area of my bib shorts with what can only be described as an irresponsible amount of nether region cream. My seated area looked like a dropped lemon meringue pie. The story does have a happy ending, however, as never in my life have I ever felt so pampered and chafe-free as I did that day. Financial repercussions would restrict me from regular such use of this product. However, on special occasions, such as my birthday or the first Sunday of each month, I will be going full lemon meringue once again. Back on the bikes, riding past familiar landmarks from day one, we were both keen to get back to the car and have this little adventure behind us, but not before our second ascent of the Franschhoek Pass. There's something about having an obstacle like this right at the end of a long ride that really makes you feel like you've earned it, whatever it may be. Cresting the final climb, we stopped for the obligatory photograph, topped up our bottles from the natural spring, and proceeded to freewheel our way down the mountain back into Franschhoek. Ending a trip like this can often come as a bit of an anticlimax. Rolling into the parking lot, quick high five between friends, pack the bikes on the car and drive off. Soon the traffic starts to build and reality slowly seeps back in. Yet despite the rather sudden realization that it's work tomorrow, you find yourself sitting in a place of relative calm. This is the beauty of a far not far kind of trip. For a few short days, you leave that world behind, and through the metronomic process of turning those pedals again and again, it's as if you've rearranged the proverbial filing cabinet and tidied the mental desk. After pushing hard on a bike for 300 or so kilometers, real-life concerns seem a little less daunting. Driving back into the city now, you sit back with a smile, ready for whatever comes next. So for the next time you feel the yearning for adventure, think about a far not far kind of trip. You won't regret it. And there you have it. My little written story piece. If you wonderful listeners are still with us, then thank you. I hope you enjoyed that. That piece was actually published on thegravelunion.cc. Some of you might be familiar with the Gravel Union and their great storytelling and platform they have. So I'll put links to the piece in the show notes. If you go to the link, you'll be able to see some of the photos of the trip, which is cool. There were some great shots. It was a wonderful trip. So that's about all we have time for today. Again, thank you if you held in there through the entirety of the show. Like, massive, massive appreciation from my side. I know it was a bit different, but please hang in there. Hang in with us. We have some cool guests, as I've said, and hopefully face to face. So we look forward to bringing you those. As always, if you like the show, head over to Spotify, Apple, wherever you listen to your podcast. A review, a rating, man, goes a long way to helping the show get noticed. But that's, as I said, that's all we have time for today. Thanks for listening. As always, get out there, get riding. Until next time, you keep well, you keep riding. Bye for now.